has to do with the symbolic nature of opera and opera characters. And before I get into this, I just want to make a point, because again, for the opera haters, who I'm generally not speaking to, and I know I'm speaking to the choir in some cases here, but we've got to make fans out of those who aren't quite sure. Yeah, opera characters seem to be extreme human beings, and I just don't mean the size of the diaphragms on the people who do the opera singing. I mean, the nature of the characters themselves tend to be extreme, one way or the other. Now, this is purposeful, and it has to do with the nature of character archetypes and symbolism that permeate the entire history of opera. Yes, the symbolic nature of opera and opera characters is the Jungian vision of opera, if you will. It posits that operatic symbols and character archetypes, intensified and abstracted profoundly by the combination of words and music, draw on our collective unconscious, that deep reservoir of images derived from our ancestral experience. And so certain characters are the way they are because they evoke both memory and reference to people we have known, or perhaps even to ourselves. Opera characters are not your typical play characters. They are extremes. They are archetypes. Robert Donington writes, "We all contain within us and recognize elements of archetypes. Opera is the great purveyor of archetypal images. Confrontation with archetypal material is likely to be cathartic. Confrontation with archetypes is the chief business of opera. That's just the nature of the beast. Thus it is that an opera may come over to us as meaningful even when the story is far from impressive. Something may stir in us which is not literally recognition, but is nevertheless akin to recognition. In every such case, I think we are getting the benefit of unsuspected associations beyond the visible exigencies of the plot and the audible suitability of the music for deepening our experience of that plot." So Donington is saying that opera characters carry within themselves, the nature of the characters, a whole series of memories and references that transcend the stories and even transcend the music. For example, Bizet's Carmen of 1875. Please let me set the scene in Act One. Carmen, of course, is that sexy little cigarette factory worker, and she has been arrested for disorderly conduct. You want to talk about a Freudian slip? Wow. Yes, the disorderly contact actually comes in Act Two. But all right, we'll get there in due time. She is being detained at this particular moment. Her hands are bound, incidentally, by a soldier named Don Jose, who has admired her from a distance. Don Jose, oh, this poor schlepper, has not a chance. He's got this squeaky, clean girlfriend named Michaela. He's a real mommy's boy. He's always saying, "How's mom? How's mom?" He's a corporal and someone who isn't going to rise a whole heck of a lot further in the service than he already is. He's clearly no match for Carmen. Even literally, with her hands tied, she dominates Don Jose. She verbally and with her eyes seduces him and convinces him to release her. These are the words that Georges Bizet was given by his librettists, Henri Mailhac and Ludovic Halévy, for this scene. Carmen turns to Don Jose and sings, "By the ramparts of Seville, at the place of Lilas Pastia, I'll go dance the seguidilla and take a glass of manzanilla. Yes, but by myself I'm bored. The only pleasure is one you can share. So I'll take along my man, and then we'll make a cozy pair. But my lover's gone to hell. Last night he went out on his ear. My poor heart's longing to forget. My heart is ever free as air. I count my beaux by dozens, but I'll have none of them. Here it is, the end of the week. And who will love me? I'll love him. Who'll take my soul? It's up for bids. You've come along at the right time, soldier boy. I can't wait a minute longer. For once, I've got a brand new lover. Dot, dot, dot. And of course, Don Jose is scandalized. Be quiet. I told you not to speak. I'm not speaking. I'm singing to myself and thinking. There's no law against thinking. I'm thinking of a certain officer who loves me and whom I could maybe love myself. And Don Jose says, Carmen. And Carmen continues, my officer's not a captain. Why, he's not even a lieutenant, just a corporal. But that's good enough for a gypsy, and I'm ready to make do with that. Of course, Don Jose is in this cold sweat now. You know, his palms are dripping, his face is red, his hair is standing on end. Carmen, I feel as if I'm drunk. If I give way, if I give in, your promise, you'll keep it? Ah, if I love you, Carmen, Carmen, you will love me? And of course, Carmen says, we. And he releases her, and she runs off. Oh, Don Jose is a real wizard now, isn't he? One wonders if there's a little royal blood somewhere in Don Jose's family line. Look, these lyrics border on the slutty, do they not? And Bizet, if he wanted to use music like The Stripper, could make this a really sleazy expose into the underside of Carmen's already jaded personality. But he does not. He takes his cue from the third line of the text, I'll go dance the seguidilla. He sets this piece as a seguidilla, a bright, moderately fast Spanish dance in triple meter. That is, it's a three-step, like a waltz. In Bizet's setting, Carmen becomes a sly, sexy, beguiling seductress. All of this with her hands tied. And she, well, is she teasing? Is she telling the truth? Don Jose doesn't know, but he doesn't have enough experience to know any better. All he knows is that his senses are completely overloaded. He releases her, and his downfall begins. And all of this, my friends, is projected through the music. Now, let's just listen to the first portion of this aria up to the point where Don Jose comes in and says, be quiet. Because I want you to hear how effectively Bizet creates this sense of teasing grace. This music dances, even with her hands tied. Carmen has terrific humor, terrific power, and all of it comes through in the understatement of this vivacious dance. So please, Bizet, Carmen, number 10. That means this is the 10th number in the opera, Seguidilla.
Oui, j'irai chez moi, mais il va se passer.
I would tell you that poor Don Jose is lost. He's never had the attention of a woman like this. And, of course, for her part, Carmen has not a clue that she has just pulled the cork on a wellspring of sexuality that she is not going to be able to put the cork back into. And Don Jose's downfall will ultimately be hers. Now, we will get to Carmen later in the course. But for now, we must talk about Carmen, the character of Carmen, as an archetype. Do we recognize Carmen? Do we know someone like Carmen? I hope we're not married to that particular person, but do we? Have we been tempted by someone or something like Carmen? Look, Carmen exists as three distinctly separate but mutually reinforcing archetypes. So, archetype number one, a character archetype. She comes from the commedia dell'arte character of Colombina. I should explain. I'll talk much more about commedia dell'arte later in the course, but for now, this is a 15th and 16th century phenomena that starts in northern Italy. The commedia dell'arte are traveling troupes of singers and actors who put on shows first across the Italian peninsula, but then these spontaneously semi-improvised shows become popular really all across Europe. And so many of the character archetypes, so many of the plot devices we are familiar with, and everything from opera to television, grew out of commedia dell'arte tradition. In any case, there is a commedia dell'arte character named Colombina. And Colombina is the archetype for Carmen. She is a pretty young woman accustomed to getting her way through street smarts, femininity, and guile. And we're going to meet other Colombina archetypes in this course. For example, when we do Rossini's The Barber of Seville, we will meet Rosina. Rosina is a Colombina. If we were doing Mozart's Così van tutte, which we're not, sadly, but if we were, we would meet a maid named Despina, again, very sly, sexy, and able to get her way through conniving and plotting. In the Coffee Cantata, which I've done in a previous teaching company course on Bach and the High Baroque, we did a wonderful comic opera by Bach called The Coffee Cantata, which features a character named Lieschen, who, again, is a young, attractive girl who has to use her wits in order to get her way. So first and foremost, Carmen is, an archetype drawn from the commedia dell'arte. She is Colombina. Second of all, she's a biblical archetype. Carmen is the serpent. She is the apple. She is Eve, all rolled into one. She's a female. She represents temptation. And her sexuality is the apple itself. Don Jose, of course, becomes Adam, the dupe whose fall from grace becomes the essential storyline of the opera. And Carmen is also a personal archetype, the third archetype. Carmen is that temptation, monetary temptation, sexual temptation, spiritual temptation, with which we have all come face to face at some time or another. And if you haven't, too bad for you. We might know it's wrong, perhaps even self-destructive. But in the face of such temptation, we are often powerless, sadly, to control ourselves. Don Jose's destruction at Carmen's hands becomes a metaphor, a surrogate for our own potential destructions. Robert Donington continues, "It is not in our nature to come up with images that mean nothing. The meanings may be more or less fragmentary or coherent, trivial or significant, but something will be welling up in even the most unpromising material. And far more interestingly, when the material is shaped by a superior intellect and a keener vision, in a word, by a genius. Almost as immediately as dreams, and far more coherently, opera offers a royal road into our unconscious, drawing as it does on regions of the psyche where consciousness has little power to penetrate. This truly is the astonishing power of theater augmented with music." Unquote. Again, the symbolic archetypal nature of music is the province of the composer. The uncanny ability of opera to delve into our unconscious, what T.S. Eliot, to repeat myself, again calls that fringe of indefinite feeling which we can only detect out of the corner of the eye. This ability of opera to evoke this is due to music, not to words. All right, let's bring all of this back around, do a little review, and listen to one more marvelous aria. Again, an opera is a drama which combines soliloquy, dialogue, scenery, action, and continuous or nearly continuous music, the whole ever greater than the parts. Opera is human experience, and that means theater, intensified, distilled, crystallized, and communicated through music. The great success of opera, varied and diverse though the genre may be, can be attributed to any number of mutually reinforcing elements. And we've talked about these. Actually, we haven't talked about the first element, and I should have brought it out right up front. The sheer beauty of vocal music and the excitement of theater. Music's beautiful and theater's fun. Put them both together, it becomes compelling. Number two, more subtly, and more importantly as far as we're concerned, the incredible intensification of feeling and meaning when words and music are combined is the essence of opera. The nonverbal, emotional nature of music can conjure moods and feelings beyond the capability of words alone. Number three, the ability of music, married to words, to evoke symbolic meaning and character archetypes. All of these elements together have allowed opera to flourish, to develop, to continue to grow and evolve, even as other arts, even as other entertainments have fallen by the wayside. Again, opera is a very old tradition, given the age of traditions here in the West. It's a tradition that spans 400 years. And for something to last that long, it has to be artistically flexible, but it also has to appeal to something basic in all of us. And indeed, opera does. We should understand all of this always in one main context, and that is that it is the composer that is the dramatist in an opera, not the writer of the libretto. All right, the goals of this course, rather late arrived on, but better late than never, are fourfold. First, to provide an outline of the history of opera from 1600, with its invention, up to 1924. The latest opera we will listen to will be Turandot by Puccini, which we sampled back in Lecture 1. However, in our engaging the history of opera, we will go back to the world of ancient Greece to understand the precedents for opera set many thousands of years before its actual invention. The second goal of this course, to observe the development of national schools of opera with the understanding that we will spend the bulk of our time, as we should, with the Italian operatic tradition. Third goal of this course, to develop a methodology for listening to and understanding opera by reading a libretto first, then discussing the composer's interpretive options, and then observing the choices made by composers in setting those words and thereby creating the characters and the dramatic situations. Fourthly, ultimately, this course is a celebration of the power of words and music. It should be fun. We should have a really good time. Okay, one last glorious example of the power of music to distill and intensify the meaning of words, even while creating archetypes with which we can all identify. We turn to Rossini's The Barber of Seville, 1816, and the entrance aria. We heard an exit aria before. That's when Elektra leaves the stage. Well, this is an entrance aria. This is when we first meet a character, and of course, this must also make a huge impression because it's the entrance aria that tells us who a character is, what they're all about, and what we can expect them to do in the near and even distant future. And this is the entrance aria for Figaro himself. Largo al factotum della città, make way for the jack of all trades of the city. If there's anyone in the world that doesn't recognize this aria, it simply means that they have not come in contact with any European music. It is one of the most oft-heard and greatest loved of all operatic arias. It is a classic comic number. Figaro is revealed immediately as a clever, fast-talking, streetwise, and cocky character. He's a kind of male Carmen with all the sexual angst removed. a man of common birth, a man who's really happy with his career. Please, let's listen to this aria in two parts. It's long, and I want to go through the words because they're great fun. Anyway, we hear Figaro approaching from the distance. What do people do when they're walking and they're really happy? They sing. And so, of course, he's singing as he approaches. La 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 la. Make way for the factotum of the city. La 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 la. Rushing to his shop, for dawn is here. La 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 la. Oh, what a merry life. What gay pleasures for a barber. Di qualità. Of quality. Yes, indeed. Ah, bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo, bravo. La 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 la. Most fortunate of men, indeed you are. Ready for everything, by day and by night, always in bustle, in constant motion. A better lot for a barber, a nobler life does not exist. La 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 la. Razors and combs, lancets and scissors, at my command, everything's ready. Then there are the extras, oh, part of the trade, of the ladies and the cavaliers. La 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 la. Ah, what a merry life, what gay pleasures for a barber of quality. Let's just sample this first half of the aria, please, and note the following two points. This bubbling, brilliant music reflects Figaro's joie de vivre and humor wonderfully. Second of all, the direct, almost pop song-like melodic material reflects Figaro's common birth. And let's quickly move through the rest of the aria because we're all hopped up and moving with it now, and it's quite wonderful. All call for me. All want me, ladies and children, old men and maidens. I need a wig. I need a shave. Leeches to bleed me. Here, take this note. All call for me. All want me. I need a wig. I need a shave. Here, take this note. Ho, Figaro. 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 Indeed, the demands of Figaro's public piled one upon the other, becoming ever more insistent. He continues, oh, heavens, what a commotion. Heavens, what a crowd. Uno alla volta, one at a time, one at a time, for pity's sake. Yes, I only have two hands. How can I service you? He becomes almost like a diva, please, trying to calm his captive audience. Quiet down, I'll get to you. And then he continues, imitating all the people calling him, ho, Figaro, I'm here. Figaro here, Figaro there, ho, Figaro, I am here, Figaro there, Figaro up, Figaro down, quicker and quicker I go like grease lighting, make way for the factotum of the city. And then the final phrase, picking up speed, faster and faster and faster as Figaro continues to service his public, the music gets louder and increasingly exciting. Ah, bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo, on you good fortune will always smile, la 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 la, I am the factotum of the city. Please, the conclusion of this brilliant aria.
Tutti mi chiedono, tutti mi vogliono, donne e ragazzi, vecchie fanciulle, di quale parrucca, cresta la barba, quale sanguigna, resta di lei, mi chiedono, mi vogliono, mi chiedono, tutti mi vogliono, quale parrucca, cresta la barba, questo biglietto, Figaro, 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 Figaro,
What an awesome entry aria. Do we like this guy? We're crazy about this guy. And everything he does from now on, we will follow with rapt attention. Now, Figaro is also an archetype. He's a character archetype. The fast-talking, conniving servant. Where we first see characters like this, I'm sure they predate Roman drama and comedy, but we first see them in Roman comedy. If you know the musical comedy, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which updates some of these old Roman comedic techniques, we know the character Pseudolus is Figaro. Indeed, the Roman servant, fast-talking and conniving, was updated by the Commedia dell'arte to create a character called Arlecchino, or Harlequin, the quick-tongued clown. Damon Runyon's version of Figaro, of course, is Nathan Detroit. TV Figaros, well, the archetype continues. I think the best example would be Sergeant Bilko. But we could come up with lots of others. An underclass person who, by street smarts, guile, and humor, gets what they want. And he's also a personal archetype. All of us. We admire Figaro's chutzpah, his intelligence, his joy, and we'd like sometimes to be able to work the world the way Figaro can work his. Now, Beaumarchais created the character Figaro, and Cesare Stolbini wrote the libretto for Rossini. Nevertheless, this Figaro is Rossini's creation. It's the music that makes him. One last quote and we move on to our next lecture. This was written by Edward Cohn, a teacher of mine. In any opera, we may find that the musical and the verbal messages seem to reinforce or to contradict each other. But whether the one or the other, we must always rely on the music as our guide toward an understanding of the composer's concept of the text. It is this conception, not the text itself, that must be authoritative in defining the ultimate meaning of the work. Indeed, in this exploration I have called Words and Music, the essential point is that the composer is the dramatist. With this in mind, let us take our lecture break. When we return, a brief history of vocal expression in music from the world of ancient Greece to 1600. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. We are midway through our introductory set of our opening four lectures, and now for lectures 3 and 4, we encounter the last part of that introductory set, a brief history of vocal expression in Western, meaning European-based music. Really, the real title, my friends, should be an all-too-brief history of vocal expression in Western music, as we pave our way, inevitably, towards the invention of opera. Now, as I've already talked about briefly, and will soon talk about in infinitely greater detail, the nature and content of opera has changed profoundly since the first court operas were produced around 400 years ago. While certain aspects of opera have changed inevitably, I mean, after all, nothing stays the same all the time, the vast changes in style and content over the last four centuries in opera are a reflection of something greater than just inevitable change. They are a reflection of a greater reality, and that reality is as follows. Operatic style, musical style, artistic expression changes not randomly and whimsically, but changes inevitably as the world changes around the composer. Now, I call this concept of change, of inevitable stylistic change, music as a mirror. The reason why we call it music as a mirror is the way that stylistic change in music and the arts mirrors the greater realities of the society in which the composer, the artist, the writer lives and works. So we've got to understand change, evolution, stylistic alteration, not as random and seemingly indiscriminate, but as a function of a greater cultural reality, a cultural reality shared by composers, playwrights, writers, and artists alike. Please then, what I call the four basic assumptions or the four tenets of music as a mirror. Tenet or assumption number one. Western, meaning European music, has exhibited ongoing stylistic change. By the way, I keep saying style. When we talk about musical style, all we're referring to is the way the music sounds. That's it. The feeling, the sensibility evoked by the sound of the music. Again, to assumption tenet number one. Western, that is European music, has exhibited ongoing stylistic change since the High Middle Ages. I'm talking about the year 1000 or so. Tenet number two. Since the High Middle Ages, composers have sought to express something of themselves, something of their world in their music. The result being that as the world around the composer changes, so does the style or the sound of that music. Tenet number three of music as a mirror. What is considered expressive changes from era to era. Now, this might not be self-evident to us, because when we think of something being expressive here in the late 20th century, we think of emotion as being expressive. I mean, if we need to express ourselves, we're talking about something in the realm of our feelings. And indeed, we live in this cult of middle-class feeling. That is, whatever we feel is legitimate and worth being expressed. But I would tell you that this cult of individual feeling is a fairly recent phenomena that we could trace back, to poets like Byron and Keats at the beginning of the 19th century. Really, before that, other things in music were considered essential to expression. For example, for a great swatch of time between about 600 and 1400, worship of God and religion were the essence of musical expression. During the 14th century, as we will talk about in a few minutes, intellect and control were considered of essential expression. And so we have highly intellectualized, highly controlled music from the 1350s and the 1360s. At other times in musical history, emotional restraint and good taste were considered paramount in any musical or indeed any artistic expression. The age of Mozart and Haydn, I'm talking about the classical era, the 1760s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, were such an era of control and restraint. Emotions and feelings unrestrained? Well, that's an expressive ideal of the 19th and the 20th century. So please, let's understand that as time changes, so will what we consider essential and expressive to the arts. And fourthly, the last assumption or tenet of music as a mirror, the rate of change in musical style, like everything else in our wild and wacky world, will increase exponentially as we move forward towards the present day. Now, I have a huge, important point to make before we move on any further regarding change in music specifically and the arts in general. My friends, music and art are not linear. They don't build cumulatively on the work of predecessors as, let's say, science does. Scientifically, medically, technologically, even socially. Are we better off today than we were 200 years ago? Oh, I think even the most abject Luddite would agree that we are indeed better off today than we were 200 years ago. But are we better off artistically? Is Shakespeare better than Sophocles? Is Tom Stoppard better than Shakespeare? No. They're just different, and their differences are a reflection of a changing world around the composer, the artist, the poet, the writer. Is Richard Strauss better than Verdi? Is Verdi better than Mozart? Is Mozart better than Monteverdi? No, of course not. They're all different, and their differences reflect their times, although I might gratuitously add that nobody is better than Mozart. So please, a brief history of vocal expression in Western music. We will do this for two reasons. First, so we can trace the evolution of expression as it's seen as we approach opera, and we will see antecedents for opera even as far back as the ancient Greek world. And number two, I need to prove to you this concept of music as a mirror. We've got to understand that musical style changes as a function of larger cultural change. The composer is not some idiot living in an ivory tower. The composer, the artist, the painter, the writer is one of us, as someone who lives in our community and reflects the same ideals and morals that surround all of us. The reason why this is important is we're going to have to understand changes in operatic style as a function of music as a mirror, as well as the music we're about to explore here in lectures 3 and 4. So we go way back in our beginnings to the music of the ancient Greek world. Now, again, one more time. Opera is a drama which combines soliloquy, dialogue, scenery, action, and continuous or nearly continuous music. The whole ever greater than the parts, if you prefer, a synergy of complementary elements. Although the earliest works we now call operas date back about 400 years, the association of music with drama goes back to ancient times. I'm going to say that again because it's really important. Although works we now call opera date back about 400 years, the association of music with drama goes back to the ancient world. The composers, poets, philosophers, and historians who invented opera in the late 16th century, firmly believed, almost religiously believed, that they were recreating, reinventing ancient Greek drama. So, we must, in this and the following lecture, we must travel back to the musical world of ancient Greece and then move forward to the invention of opera. In doing so, we will examine the ongoing search for constantly relevant modes of musical expression, those modes of expression that do lead us ultimately to opera. All right, the ancient world. I quote the eminent music historian Donald Grout. The word music had a much wider meaning to the Greeks than it has to us here today. It was an adjectival form of muse. In classical mythology, any one of the nine sister goddesses who presided over certain arts and sciences. The verbal relation suggests that among the Greeks, music was thought of as something common or basic to activities that were concerned with the pursuit of truth and beauty. In the teachings of Pythagoras and his followers, music and arithmetic were not separate arts. Numbers were thought to be the key to the whole spiritual and physical universe, so the system of musical sounds and rhythms, being ordered by the numbers of the overtone series, exemplified the harmony of the cosmos and corresponded to it. The doctrine of ethos, of the moral quality and effects of music, fitted well into the Pythagorean view of music as a microcosm, a system of pitch and rhythm ruled by the same mathematical laws that operate in the whole of the visible and invisible creation. Music, in this view, was not only a passive image of an orderly system of the universe, it was also a force that could affect the universe, hence the attribution of miracles to the legendary musicians of mythology. And my friends, we will meet the most legendary of these musicians, Orpheus, throughout the entire history of opera. Orpheus, as we will talk about him, is the personification of the operatic ideal, a singer with a golden voice who can change the face of nature and the souls of people with music. Back to Mr. Grout. The Greek idea of music as essentially one with the spoken word has appeared in diverse forms throughout the history of music, in the invention of opera around 1600, for example, or in Wagner's theories about music drama in the 19th century. And we will talk, of course, about the invention of opera, but also about Wagner's ideas based on his view of ancient Greek theater and music in due time. All right, the upshot of all of this is that music would seem to have been ubiquitous in the ancient Greek world. Music was used to accompany sporting events. I mean, can we imagine that here today? We have a band, above one of the dugouts at a baseball game, not just playing fight songs to the crowd, but actually accompanying the players while they played, or at a track meet. That would be a most interesting thing to letter in, a varsity trumpet. It's just something we don't do anymore. Indeed, in the Pan-Hellenic Games, singing and instrumental performance were sporting events. There were competitions in singing, in kithara, that is these big lyre playing, and so forth. There's also a great likelihood that much, if not most, if not all, Greek drama was actually chanted or sung. Now, sadly, only 40 fragments of ancient music, that is, pre-Christian music, have come down to us today. Of that incredible world, the ancient world, only 40 fragments of music. They've been destroyed by time because, let's face it, if you write down music, you're not generally going to be etching it in stone. It's going to go onto paper. It's going to go onto some very dissolvable medium. And I would also tell you that, sadly, the early Christian church ravaged what they considered the repertoire of paganism. So much of what was destroyed in the early days of Christianity as a way of removing pagan influences from a new world. Now, one of these surviving fragments of ancient music comes from a play named Orestes by the famed dramatist Euripides. And we know who Orestes is. Orestes is, of course, the brother of Electra, who killed... Well, I'll get into that in just a minute. First, the fragment. This fragment from Euripides' Orestes is on a papyrus, and it dates back, the papyrus does, to about the 3rd century BCE. My friends, BCE is a politically correct way to say BC. Instead of saying before Christ, we say before the Christian era. And now, of course, everyone can be included in this, not just, especially the biggest problem is with AD, Anno Domini, year of our Lord. Better to say CE, common era, or Christian era. In any case, the fragment we have of Euripides' Orestes, or this bit of music, comes down to us on a papyrus that's dated to the 3rd century BCE. The tragedy itself was written about 408 BCE, and it's possible that the music that has survived and come down to us on this later papyrus was even composed by Euripides himself, who was renowned for his musical settings. The fragment that has survived the ravages of time is a stasimon. It's an ode sung by the chorus as it stood in its place at the orchestra. The orchestra is that semicircular lip beneath the stage, between the stage and the audience. And, of course, in the early operas, when instrumentalists started being put in the orchestra, that lip between the stage and the audience, the ensemble came to be known by the place where they were sitting, and that means the orchestra. Anyway, this fragment that's come to us is a chorus, and that chorus would have been sung from that lip. The fragment is that, just a fragment, so any performance, of course, will have to be a recreation, and we will hear a recreated performance in a moment. In this stasimon chorus, the women of Argos beg the gods to have mercy on poor Orestes, who, 6 days before the play began, as we all know from the discussion regarding Electra from Lecture 1, killed his mom, Clytemnestra, and her main squeeze, Aegisthus. Orestes and Electra together have plotted the killing in revenge for the murder of their own father, Agamemnon. The chorus begs that Orestes be released from the madness that has overwhelmed him since the killing. They sing this. You wild goddesses who dart across the skies, seeking vengeance for murder, we beg you to free Agamemnon's son from his raging fury. We grieve for this boy. Happiness is brief among mortals. Sorrow and anguish sweep down on it like a swift gust of wind on a sailship, and it sinks under the tossing seas. So the women are trying to say to the gods, remember this is a boy, remember he is a mortal, remember he was avenging his father in murdering his mother. Let's listen, please, and I want you to be aware of the following two elements while we listen. It's a brief excerpt. Please, this is being sung by a single voice accompanied by a double reed instrument, an oboe-like instrument that the Greeks called an aulos, A-U-L-O-S. Secondly, and more importantly, note that this is what we call a syllabic setting. What that means is that there's a different pitch for each syllable. When you syllabically set words, you guarantee maximum articulation, maximum clarity of the words. It also means that the rhythms of the music are completely dependent upon the words themselves. Everything is meant for clear articulation. So here is a case where the words are transcendent. The music accompanies the words, but clarity of word is the transcendent element in this excerpt. Please, Euripides, Stasimon Chorus, chorus from Orestes. All right, I don't think this is going to make anyone's top 40 list of favorite tunes heard today, but please understand, in its context, this is most memorable and most tuneful. In its context, a context 2,500 years removed from today. The point is this. The ancient Greeks believed that music represented the true heart of humankind and the order of the cosmos. They believed that music could change the face of nature and alter the souls of people and animals. Now, this is a marvelous view of music. It's a deeply expressive view of music. It's an essentially humanistic view of music. And this humanistic view of music will be lost for about 1,000 years for reasons that we will get into right now, because we must move forward to what we call the Middle Ages. By the year 600 CE, that is 600 of the Common or Christian era, Roman municipal authority, which had been the societal and cultural glue that had held most of Western Europe together for the last 700 years, had been almost completely destroyed. One Roman institution, however, survived. It stood as a lonely bastion against encroaching barbarity, brutality, and ignorance. And that, of course, was the Roman-based Christian church. The Roman Christian church had been founded by the Emperor Constantine way back in the 4th century. This church had developed, by and large, its own hierarchy, its own structure, its own internal governance, largely separate from that of the Roman state. So the church's survival into the Middle Ages was a function of its lack of dependence on Roman municipal authority. And I would also tell you that the church's survival into the Middle Ages, for which we must be very grateful, and the subsequent Christianization of Western and Northern Europe, provided the necessary framework for the reemergence of a European civilization around the years 900 or 1,000 or so. I feel sometimes filled with guilt and remorse, the way we toss around these 100, 200, 300, 400-year chunks as if they were but a day or a second. We've got to remember that culturally, societally, everything evolves slowly, geologically, and certainly if we were living back in 900, we wouldn't want to be told, especially if we were onion-eating peasants, that congratulations, Europe's being reborn even while you live your life expectancy of 25 years, toothless and broken-boned that you are. Yeah, we make these grand statements about huge chunks of history without taking into account the incredible details that make history what it is. I share my guilt with you as a way of purging it from myself. I continue. We generally call the huge period of time between the years 600 and 1400, yes, talk about a big chunk of time, we call this huge period of time the Middle Ages. Since the social, philosophical, artistic, even political institutions of the Middle Ages were by and large dominated by religion, issues of Christianity, we also call this 800-year chunk of time the theocratic age, or the age of the theocracy. Now, during the first part of this theocratic age, the so-called Dark Ages, 600 to 1,000, the great bulk of the music created was music to be used in Christian worship. This is the music of the Catholic Church. It is music of limited purpose. It was music created purposefully to aid in worship. The Greek ideal of humanist expression, well, that's lost or disregarded at this point. All pagan ritual, all pagan art was discarded in order to focus on the new liturgy, the new belief, the new spiritual cleanliness that was early Christianity. Instrumental accompaniment was generally forbidden. Please, this is a course on vocal music and opera, but please remember that instrumental music does not become a form of music unto itself until fairly late, until the 1600s. Before the 1600s, if you heard instrumental music, you would be hearing dance music. And when instruments play dance music, what part of our body responds? I mean, what part of us starts to groove? Do we think about God? Do we ruminate upon our small place in the cosmos? No. No. The bottom half of our body moves, you know, the part of our bodies that reproduce. And indeed, dance has often been called stylized reproductive ritual. Yes, instruments can only make us think about those parts of our body most useless to praise and worship of God. And so instruments are discouraged, if not outright outlawed, in the early church. Rather, plain chant, that is, unadorned singing, sometimes called Gregorian chant, becomes the music of the church. And we have a huge and varied repertoire of this plain chant created to serve the liturgical needs of the church. Let's listen to such a plain chant. The repertoire is huge. I mean, you can't have a clue unless you've studied how much plain chant there is, how varied it is depending on the region in which it was created. And it was created over a period of 400, 500, 600 years. And most of it, or much of it, at least as of about 900 or so, was written down. So this is a gigantic repertoire, perhaps the single largest chunk of music that exists in our Western culture. It's easy to find, and it's hard to choose because so much of it is so beautiful and so representative. I chose for us to listen to now the opening, or the introit, for the Mass for Christmas Day, a number called A Child is Born to Us. Here are the words that we will hear set to music. A child is born to us, and a son is given to us, whose government is upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called the Angel of Great Counsel. Now listen and note the following, please. This is music of great and enduring lyric beauty, and it is. But it is also music utterly devoid of personal expression or ego. I mean, when we listen to this plain chant, do we say, ah, that must have been written by Father Billy of Bayonne. I mean, I recognize his style right away. Or was that Padre Brad of Bruges? Or maybe Reverend Bud of Bern? No, we can't identify the composer. This is generic-sounding music, which sounds like so much other music. We cannot possibly say who the creator was. It is music intended as prayer, music intended as ritual, a mirror of its church, not of the individual ego that created it. Please, let's listen, and then we'll discuss it some more. Very beautiful. I would ask us all to think now, what is being expressed in this music? What is this music about? Well, first and foremost, it's about peace. It's about love of God. It's a sublime, communally sung religious song that celebrates a transcendent divinity. This music does not celebrate any particular individual's feelings, worldview, or ego. And that's an important point, one we have to take with us as we enter the High Middle Ages, the era that sees Europe reborn between about 1000 and 1400. Again, another huge chunk of time. Again, I feel the hot coals of intellectual responsibility raked across my feet. But nevertheless, we will address that huge chunk of time as the High Middle Ages. All right, this is the era that sees Europe essentially reborn. Political alliances grow, countries come into existence, the merchant class grows and develops, trade routes are reestablished, and so forth. Food production is increased hugely, and correspondingly populations grow due to windmills, water mills, crop rotation, and horse as opposed to ox-drawn plows. Population growth increases tremendously, and cities develop. London, Paris, Venice, Bruges all grow. Please remember, a city is that greatest of all cooperative human ventures. Specialization can take place within a city, and if we can specialize, we can develop to much greater levels those things in which we